special art focus this morning. We have a guest host is Tom Kramer, and his guest is Gus Van Sant. So do stay tuned, and here is Tom and Gus.
Thank you so much, and this is KBOO, 90.7 FM on your dial, and I'd like to thank Julie Bernard for having me host the show today. And I had quite a bit of trouble finding somebody until just the other day I called Gus, and he was nice enough to agree to go on, which is a very, very special thing. And I don't think you've ever been on the show, have you, Gus?
I haven't, no.
Great. It's great to have you. Thank you so much. Thanks. For coming on. We're just going to kind of free-form a little bit today, and we're going to talk about his work and how it relates to the larger art scene. And I'm coming from a position we talked earlier today about how film is just part of the whole cosmology of the general art, what art is all about, including painting, sculpture, printmaking, and in the 20th century, the advent of film. Now, what is your, how do you see how film is tying in with your, I think your background, like a lot of other people listening right now, are in the actual visual arts like painting, and you went to RISD, right?
Yeah, Rhode Island School of Design,
right.
In Providence, Rhode Island.
Right. And did you start out as a painter? That's what I understand.
Yeah, I was, when I was much younger, I was a painter. Say when I was in junior high school, there was an influential painting teacher, Robert Levine. And
yeah, I've definitely heard the name.
He was, there's a yeah, illustrator named Robert Levine as well. But
oh,
this
maybe.
Guy was,
okay.
This guy was yeah. Different.
Okay.
And he
and where was this? Was this the
in Darien, somewhere? Connecticut?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know,
yeah.
White bread community.
Before that, yeah.
Yeah. And I did that, and after a while, I got very interested in film because there was an English teacher named David Sohn who'd written this book called Stop, Look, and Write, and he started showing films in his English class. And I was in, they were experimental films from the Canadian Film Board. So I was interested in it, and I started to understand just by reading about New York underground films, which I could either go see because we were only an hour away from New York, or else I could read about them in books that I bought a book called The American Underground Cinema, and those guys were mostly painters who were working in films. So it started there, and then later I kind of worked my way into like a more traditional Hollywood situation where they were dramatic, films.
Yeah. The one thing that's really interesting is that when you look at your, everyone knows your films out there, right? Because you're obviously this kind of internationally recognized figure. But one thing about them is that those of us listening right now probably know that there is that strong influence of this kind of art in your work, that you just describe them as being kind of Hollywood, but they also, like Hitchcock and Kubrick and other greats, there's kind of a insertion of a high art kind of focus to them. So to me, they succeed in both dimensions. And one thing I always like to tell everybody on this show is that one of the primary objectives of all art is the issue of entertainment. If there's not something engaging or entertaining or rewarding, then what's the point, In other words, John Cage kind of work is theoretically great, but not necessarily aesthetically great. Would you agree with that? Or?
It depends on how you're listening. Like, I've never seen a John Cage performance, the ones
right.
that are famous for having most of the audience walk out.
Yeah, that's right.
And, yeah, I've never really experienced a real John Cage performance.
Right.
I've read about them, and I've always thought they're fantastic, and I think that the certain periods in, French art making, say, the 20s and 30s and the
Dada movement, is that what you mean?
Or the Dadaists or Surrealists.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the thing that they were all after was the highest compliment would be for the audience to riot, to actually not just walk out, but to, like, rip the seats apart.
That's really interesting.
I mean, that was their concept of, like, a success, which is probably not our modern-day concept, depending on, like, maybe it is.
Would you say a modern version of that would be the Sex Pistols at Winterland in San Francisco in 1978, where kind of riots broke out and they tore the whole place up? And, it was kind of this hippie nightclub, and the Sex Pistols show up and just cause practically, cacophony and riots. And I know the Dead Kennedys used to have shows where the whole place was just completely torn up afterwards.
Those would be rock and roll successes, yeah.
Right. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you, since you I guess it's okay to ask this. You are, I would say anyway, kind of, to some extent, I think, influenced by the 60s, you know, the countercultural aspects of the 60s. I know in previous interviews I've read about your work. To what extent have things like psychedelic drugs and psychedelic culture informed your work in addition to the history of film and the traditional history of art? Would you say that they have effect, that has affected also your work? In other words, not just the mainstream, straight, sort of linear take on our history, but also the idea that, you know, your friendship with Ken Kesey and so forth, and Ken Kesey was interested in slowing our culture down enough to actually look at it. That's what he talked about a lot, that he wanted to change the world and stuff like that. And he also said, if you want to change the world, you have to do it. Are you interested in that sense? In I know you're interested in critiquing our current situation, but is that a conscious part of what you're after in your work?
Today?
Yeah.
Well, I think when I was starting out, it was the 60s. I was sort of on the tail end of the 60s, and I was, in 1966 I was 14. 69 I was 17.
Yeah, that's old enough to remember.
Old enough to, like sort of have that culture influencing things. I think that the filmmakers that I was mostly looking at were part of that kind of bohemian culture, like Stan Brakhage, or there were people like Ed Emshwiller, and then there was Michael Snow from Canada, and those guys were I think everybody was sort of dabbling in some kind of altered, you know, state experience of some kind, whether it's was meditation or from the beatniks coming from, you know, Ginsberg meditating, or religious experiences or drug experiences. Then Kesey had his own sort of almost like religious situation,
right?
With the acid tests and going beyond that and trying to have that be part of the work. I don't think that I've ever used like psychedelic experiences for the work, but then the work sometimes influenced by something like that.
Yeah.
Or it's hard to say.
Well, I think that
I never made stoner art.
Right.
Which I think is a
That's true. I mean, your work, I think, is more on the, I mean, if I had to force at gunpoint to say what it's like, it's more on the Velvet Underground, Andy Warhol, East Coast bohemian thing rather than the West Coast, Ken Kesey, acid test, you know, Deadhead, Jefferson Airplane thing. Now, let's talk a little bit about your interest in music, which is segueing right what we were talking about. I know that you are also a musician, as well as a visual artist and a photographer and a filmmaker. What to effect, and I read in an interview one time that during the editing of My Own Private Idaho, you actually were kind of meditatively playing on a guitar while you were looking at it and mm-hmm. making decisions.
Yeah.
Do you have kind of a interest in a spontaneous or randomness in terms of how you put your work together?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think sort of coming from maybe even like collage work that I did when I was quite young,
mm-hmm.
and maybe influenced by people like Rauschenberg, who were like tearing pieces of Life magazines up and like rubbing them on pieces of paper. And I did a lot of that, you know, during that period of time. And I think later, and even today, there's an instinct to just throw things together, just to see how the chance of throwing them together will make them start working or not, you know. Or you can say, all right, let's not do it that way, or let's throw them together again. And with film, because everything is so divided and separate, like different shots and different moments in time, that you can very easily throw things together. I mean, the way you're watching them usually is thrown together. When you're shooting something, you're shooting it perhaps out of order, or you're just randomly like getting rolls back that haven't been put in order because the lab has put it together in their own way. And so all of a sudden you start seeing things out of order, which might look better than in order. And yeah, there's a lot of that sort of collage like thought process going on in pretty much all the films. I mean, as much as I can. Sometimes I completely negate that just to see if I can play the game, you know, like the more traditional game.
Yeah. Well, it seems like collage and film is collage, right?
Yeah, in the end, it kind of is. Basically,
now that you
like,
said that, I mean, I'm realizing right now it's
lots of little pictures going by.
One thing I wanted to ask you, why do you live here? You could live anywhere in the whole world, obviously. Somebody like you, what is it about this particular Northwest Portland, Oregon region that? I mean, you even moved to New York for a while and came back here. What is it about this area that attracts you, do you think? And is it important for you to be here in order for you to be an artist and do your work?
Yeah, it helps the art a lot because you're away from maybe places that would influence you because you're just in a region. Say if you're in LA or New York, you're, you know, subject to the same things that happen to the other artists that are there, and mm-hmm. So your ideas tend to like come from, if they're coming from your daily life, and your daily life is informed by, you know, I guess like a transit worker strike or something like that, it's influencing everyone else in that same city. So I've been you know, being here, it's a lot more removed, so you just tend to like think about your own things when you're not in the bigger cities. But I think I'm here because my family moved around. We're from Kentucky, and they moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. And this is the first place that they lived where it wasn't like a business community of a big city. It was a city unto itself, and
right.
It just felt like
that's interesting.
It worked as a community. It was a community, and all the other places that I lived weren't really communities. They were just places that families were living on their way to someplace else.
I know what you mean.
So I think I just sort of felt at home here and kept coming back here.
How do you follow the Portland art scene much at all, or do you not, or not? I mean, what do you think about what's going on now? Do you think it's exciting?
Yeah, I'm not really up to speed with what's going on, or haven't been even like for the past 10 years. So.
Yeah.
Like we were talking about this before.
We're sort of old school, right? And
we were up on what was going on in Portland in 1980 or something like that.
Yeah.
But so much has happened, and, you know, it's as I guess Bruce Gunther said on the radio, a cauldron of, you know, different artistic experiments, and which it is, and it's really interesting to see, like, the works that are coming out, well, film works, for instance, that are coming out
like
of the city.
Todd Haynes, Vanessa Renwick, and others are like that.
Well, Todd's like, you know, hugely established artist,
right.
but
Steve Doughton or
Matt McCormick and he's also like at this point Mr. Establishment, you know. But all the, you know, the even younger kids that are just showing up like this year.
Yeah, same thing in the visual arts. There's a lot of amazing new fresh kind of talent moving in. It's very exciting, and I don't know whether it's going to last or whether it's just a blip on the radar screen or. But it seems sort of similar to kind of what happened in the late 50s in San Francisco with the beat movement, all the guys moving out to San Francisco. And then suddenly San Francisco became a global place. You know, before that it was a very provincial place. But now San Francisco is kind of done, isn't it? I mean, there isn't much going on down there. This is probably...
No, there's probably plenty going on down there. But I'm not in touch with that either.
I know
so
either.
Much.
But I just meant, like, the gallery scene down there seems sort of somehow depressing or bleak or not happening, at least when I go down there, because I think it's so expensive for people starting out that they're pushed out to the East Bay, for example.
Or Portland.
How about the whole, do you mind talking about this? I was going to ask you, do you identify yourself as a, like, gay artist and filmmaker, or is that part of... A lot of your films have subject matter which is kind of hinting at that, but maybe not overtly. I mean, Hitchcock did that also. You know, Norman Bates is probably gay, you know, and has this thing with his mother and this kind of whatever.
Well, my first film, Malinoche, was I don't know, it was a Skid Row gay love story. And right. it played the gay festivals, and I'm gay, so it was
right.
sort of my coming out movie in a way. And since then, there have been a lot of projects that haven't really had gay themes. I mean, My Own Private Idaho was sort of a big one, and they haven't really been. Also, it's sort of hard to find that elusive kind of middle of the road gay story.
Right.
I've noticed mine have always been sort of on the streets or transgressive in some way.
Do you sometimes in your films I've noticed a thing where women often are portrayed as kind of something that interferes with male friendship or bonding? Is that something that is a conscious thing, or is it something that's not there and it's only my imagination? Or I mean, it's often true with Hitchcock's work as well. That sort of like for example, in The Birds, Tippi Hedren opens the door, and all of a sudden the birds come in. It's an analogy to Pandora's box.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything like that going on in
your
movies?
Well, there probably is, but I'm not positive that it's a conscious thing. But which instances are you?
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm just curious. And you said I could ask you anything, so I thought I'd ask you something kind of controversial. But I've noticed sometimes that some things like that are there in the work, but not necessarily consciously there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, I think that if you're working, at least for me, the way I mostly like to work is to try and let your subconscious figure things out for you. And I just recently read this article about computers learning to play chess.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the New Yorker, and
mm-hmm.
They were hard for the designers to get the machines to think, to have a subconscious, but that the best human players claimed that, you know, when they were really advanced players, that they were, you know, they had to let their subconscious work for them, or else they'd never be able to think ahead of the game, which apparently, like, chess game has enough variables of how it might, how any game might result, enough different ways that the game can be played that are somehow more atoms that are in the universe, or there's some bizarre.
It's an incredible
statistic.
Game.
So, yeah. So like, in order to actually harness that, you know, the strategy of playing chess. I mean, this for the top players, the subconscious is where they go. And for me, I'm usually trying to do that. And you can be very distracted by being brought into the conscious, because somebody might say, you know, point out something that's very obvious that is literal, and it might have one meaning, but you want that particular thing to have, you know, 1,000 meanings. So in order to really think that way, you really have to go somewhere other than you know, a moment by moment interpretation.
Right. One thing about your work, though, that you didn't just say that I will say for you, is that there is a strong emotionalism in your work that you feel. I mean, there's this kind of penetration into the human psyche that you're able to do, but I don't know how you do it when you're looking at your works. It's like you do it, well, with Elephant, you did it with the Beethoven brilliant use of the Moonlight Sonata, for example, and the slow motion thing, but that I can pinpoint. But there's a quality of what is that? Is it an X factor? Is that what you're saying? Is that stuff like that is stuff in art that you really can't explain?
Well, bringing meaning into the images, or...
Or just having emotional content in art in general, is that something that cannot be manufactured?
I mean, for me at least, you're sort of bringing experience into play with the moment, because you have to, you know, for me, I go, if I'm shooting a film, I go onto the set, and it's still just a set, and I'm still just like the director that comes in, and the crew's all looking at you like, do you know what you're doing? And you know you kind of don't know what you're doing, but mm-hmm. you do have a lot of experience, so you kind of know which ways not to go and which ways to go. And for us on Elephant, at least, we were, you know, experimenting very in a intense way, because we didn't have a screenplay.
Right.
And we had to, you know, figure out what we were doing. Were we going to make you know, a John Cassavetes type of film where the kids really, you know, were in deep discussions about different things, you know, in their lives, or were we going to do something else? And in the case of Elephant, we were just sort of making it up from the first shot and letting it lead us where we wanted it to go. And after the first shot, we, you know, conferred. And my big sort of partner in that was Harris Savitas, the cinematographer. Mm-hmm. So we would sort of look at each other,
brilliant,
and almost not talk. We would sort of shrug and, like, point and nod, you know, or, like, pick up a different lens or something.
Yeah.
And it kind of forged itself, you know. But that's a good example of just sort of you're making it up, but you're also using what you have in your past to at least inform you. You know?
Right. Totally.
I think for some people it was like a huge failure. So like that experimentation was like not right.
I think it worked great.
And then for others it was successful.
I have noticed that you're very good, and you seem to have a great understanding of music and its role in film, and that's an example, you know, the use of the Beethoven piece.
Yeah, that particular the Beethoven piece in Elephant was one of the kids playing one of the killers in the movie was in his killer outfit, and he was at a piano, which was in the lunchroom, and he was playing that song.
Right.
And I just had this, you know, image. So it was really kind of, a lot of that type of thing was coming out of the set and out of the kids themselves.
by the spur of the moment, you mean?
Well, it's something that if you take piano lessons, it's something that you might learn as a beginner.
Right.
It's one of the things that he knew, at least, and it was coming, like the music was coming out of things that they knew, that they had in their heads, the kids that were going to high school at the time.
Yeah.
We made it. We're trying to, like, get into their, like, existence.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I wanted to get into, because we're kind of running out of time a little bit, unfortunately, is do your last two movies, one's about kind of a school shooting, the other one's loosely based on Kurt Cobain's last days, do these movies in any way reflect your own personal outlook on what's going on in our society, and kind of that is to say we're in trouble and so forth? I mean,
yeah, no, it definitely has been formed by, you know, your outlook on where you know, where you are just in the world, where the world is. It's usually, for me, a reaction to...
Is the world getting worse, do you think, since the 60s and since you're growing up? I mean, has it declined and gotten more apocalyptic?
I mean, it's also informed just by my own... I mean, I'm growing older, so I reached 50 in, you know, a few years ago. And
well, you know what Picasso said, youth has no age, so I don't...
But
practice.
I think, you know, you're maybe aware, in a new way, aware of your own mortality. And I'm not sure if it's the Earth's mortality. A lot of times I think you can interpret the world in your own fashion, you know, your own, like, sense of your own mortality. So I'm not sure that the world would actually be going to hell in a handbasket, but it seems like it.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
It does.
It really, ever since...
I mean, it kind of dawned on me the other day that, you know, scenes out of 1984, George Orwell's book and the film that was made from it's like a comic of a completely oppressive society that it seems like that's what's going on. The type of kind of
I agree
surface like information that, you know, Big Brother administered to his people. I mean, Orwell made it so that it was quite surface. We could tell that it was a surface lie,
right?
And that there's a lot of things said in the media today by our leaders that have that same feeling of like, you know, are they going to buy this, or is the public going to buy this or not? And the public does, sort of like in 1984. So it finally came.
It's scary, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Have you ever thought about doing a science fiction? No, I mean, science fiction has become science fact, but something in that sort of genre of...
No, I've never thought of doing that.
Yeah, that might be interesting to think about. I don't know. But... Now, I was going to also ask you, another thing that I think is going on in the art world right now, and in film and art and music and everything, is the all prevalent influence of pop culture, and even it's, you know, infiltrating. What I mean by that is, like, high art, traditional high art has sort of disappeared, and everything has become kind of influenced by the media, I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to be avant-garde, because the minute you are trying to do something new, it's appropriated by somebody else.
Yeah.
Do you think about that? Or
yeah, I mean, I've always been influenced by, I mean, everything probably I've done is completely influenced by the media, even though I don't really want it to be. And a lot of things that happen to me in my real life, in my non-media life, I try to pull that in, but it's like heavily influenced by the media. But my reaction is generally to do whatever I can to subvert whatever that would be, you know. So
subvert what, the media or subvert?
Yeah, the media. So yeah. Like a lot of the, I mean, I guess films have been like moving faster and faster since, I guess, MTV showed up in the 80s.
You mean in the editing and all that?
Yeah,
I noticed that.
You know, how fast the film's like.
And one thing I really liked about Last Days, by the way, was that it was not that way. It was very slow.
Right, and it's
ambient.
Not that way because it's a reaction to,
right.
You know, what, you know, the popular.
Would you say Brian Eno is an influence, for example? He's
yeah,
a great
Brian,
artist
yeah,
that's very slow, you know, who
yeah,
I really
Eno's
liked.
Very much an influence.
Yeah.
And mostly his, you know, sort of soundscapes and things.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing. Do you think that, what thing are you thinking about doing next? I heard a rumor that you've been talking to the Grateful Dead about doing something about them.
Yeah, there was a suggestion to do a, because of the Dylan documentary that was on PBS, I think that everyone got excited about doing a Grateful Dead documentary, and it was mentioned. I don't know if that will go past mentioning. I mean, there was a brief discussion, but
well, I didn't mean. To
I think there's a lot of there's a lot of hurdles for a project like that.
Yeah.
For me, at least, or at least, and also for you know, funding and for, you know, it's sort of one of those things. It's just a thought.
Yeah.
I know that this is one station that has a Grateful Dead afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty dead friendly around here. I like them. I know a lot of people, the quickest way to clear a hipster party these days is to tell them you like the Grateful Dead, but I've always stood up for them. Anyway, is there anything else we didn't cover? I'm trying to think of.
Well, local painters, you're going to talk about.
Well, there's a lot of great local artists, and I asked several of them to be on, but they turned me down. Can you believe you didn't turn me on? I really appreciate you coming on.
So who are you wanting?
Well, I asked, like, I think I even talked to Jeff Yon for some names, and I talked to one of his guys who was out of town, and then I asked Michael Brophy, you know, the landscape painter, you know his work, and then a few other people, and Jack Ierley, who's an amazing guy. I was telling you about him earlier, you know, the
right.
Carnival ride guy that he's from Salem and he knew Clifford Gleason. And but anyway, do you still, I want to ask you real quick, do you still paint and draw in addition, I mean, to in collage?
Not
and all that?
No, not I'd like to, but it's just it's not something that that I've been doing a lot lately. But yeah.
What do you do when you're not doing filmmaking?
Sometimes I go
on
assignment.
Seconds.
I go on assignment to take still photographs.
Okay.
I do that.
Well, okay, I've seen some of those. Those are incredible.
And that's sort of rare for me, so like, I get excited when I actually get a job doing that.
Well, Gus, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks.
Unfortunately, we have to go off the air. I really appreciate it. We just were speaking with Gus Van Zandt. This is Tom Kramer at Art Focus, substituting for Julie Bernard. Really appreciate you listening, and have a nice holiday season, and we will sign off. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks.